This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the fourth week of September, and this week, Ruth Bader Ginsburg became the first woman and first Jewish person to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Ginsburg died last Friday at the age of 87 from complications of pancreatic cancer. She served 27 years on the court as an icon of its liberal wing. Her death creates an opening on the court less than 2 months before the election, one Republicans are hurrying to fill with a conservative replacement. We're recording this show on Friday morning, and President Trump has said he intends to announce a nominee on Saturday. We have some suppositions about who he's likely to pick, and by the time you're listening to this show, the pick may have already been announced. On next week's show, we'll talk extensively about the nominee, but for now, let's look at Ginsburg's legacy and what her death is likely to mean for the future of law in America. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review on the right, and on the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Hello.
Hey there.
Hello, Josh.
Our special guest this week is Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Josh.
So what is going to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg's lasting effect on the law?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg's primary lasting effect is her fight for equality. She was a fierce litigator in the 1970s for fighting gender discrimination. And so a lot of the law that we now take for granted that requires the government to treat people the same of different genders, unless there's a really good reason to treat them differently, we got a lot of that law from cases that Ginsburg brought. And then when she was on the Supreme Court, she kind of put a cap stone on that area of litigation in a case involving the all-male admissions policy of the Virginia Military Institute. Since then, she's continued to be a real advocate for equality in all kinds of forms. And so she's very well known, for example, for a dissent she wrote in the voting rights case, Shelby County versus Holder in 2013. That was a case in which the conservative majority said that things had changed enough in the South and other places with a history of voting discrimination, mostly against Black people, and that it was time to lift various protections against that kind of racial discrimination. And Ginsburg said no. And she had this great line. She said it was like taking down your umbrella when your umbrella is what's preventing you from getting wet. And so that's also an important part of her legacy.
Jamel, I think it's interesting the focus on Ginsburg's dissents. And I realize that this isn't something that just happens for liberal members of the court. Scalia also had famous dissents that his fans were big fans of. But it's sort of, I think, emblematic of where liberals have been in a lot of jurisprudence that she would end up being known so much for cases in which her side was losing.
Yeah, I think that's right. Over the last 10 years, especially, there have been these, you know, major cases. Well, let's say over the last 15 years, there have been these major cases where Ginsburg has been in the minority and thus articulated the mainstream liberal position in a very forceful way. And I think that has helped, you know, solidify her icon status in the eyes of many liberals, even as it is indicative of the extent to which on these, you know, questions like voting rights, campaign finance, these questions of political economy that come to the court, liberals have been on the losing end. I know that on social issues, it's been a little different. And I think Michael might want to speak to that.
Yeah, Michael, what do you make of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy from a conservative perspective?
Well, you know, there's a couple of points to it. I mean, her icon status that has been referred to, I think, really has only become achieved in the last half decade. You know, a book came out, I think, that called The Notorious RBG that sort of transposed this internet fan culture onto, you know, a feminist icon. And a lot of the celebration was about her litigation before she was on the court and a little less about her opinion writing. So, you know, I personally think that the kind of icon status that conservatives gave Justice Scalia and that progressives are giving Ruth Bader Ginsburg is probably an unhealthy sign in a democratic polity to kind of, you know, it's in a way it's we're kind of giving in to the idea that the justices on the Supreme Court are these philosopher kings and queens that we just have to honor from a great distance rather than, you know, our sense of ourselves as a self-governing people. So I've been a little disturbed by that, but there's no doubt that she's one of the most remarkable people of the 20th century and into the 21st.
Emily, that icon status, I think a lot of people have misgivings about it in the way that Michael describes there, especially with how that relates to the circumstances we're in right now, which is to say in 2013, 2014, there was significant pressure on Ginsburg to retire at that point. Also some pressure on Justice Stephen Breyer, who's 5 years younger than her, that they needed to get off the court at that time when there was a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate so that they could be replaced with other liberal judges who were younger, who would serve for decades afterward, because otherwise the concern was exactly this situation, that she would die before she had another opportunity to retire under a Democratic president, and she would be replaced in such a way that the court would move to the right. I mean, if we thought of justices more as just people who do a job and who apply a certain judicial philosophy rather than being so indispensable as individuals, wouldn't that have led us to a better decision here for liberals that would have led to a less conservative court in the long run?
Yes, I think it probably would. And I share Michael's misgivings about the kind of celebrity culture of Supreme Court justices. It just creates a kind of mushing together of law and politics that makes me uncomfortable. That said, I think the real problem we have with Supreme Court appointments in the United States is life tenure for Supreme Court justices. Almost no other country in the world does it this way. It means that we have these people in tremendously powerful positions for decades and decades. And I just think that's like too much power to give any one individual over a course of 25 or more years. And I think that the way in which the timing of the death of a justice, whether it's Antonin Scalia or in 2016 or now with Justice Ginsburg, it just has a warping too huge effect on American politics. And I am very much in favor of set terms. 18 years is a good number that you could pick for Supreme Court justices. Some people think you would need a constitutional amendment to make that happen. Other people think actually you could rotate them onto the appeals courts without changing the Constitution. In any case, from a policy perspective, I think it would address a lot of the concerns you raise.
One thing that I've been hearing from both liberals and conservatives in recent days is a wish that the court was less powerful and less central in our politics, that basically the court would be less polarized if it was at the center of fewer key policy arguments that polarize the country. And while that sounds nice to me in theory, I'm sort of struggling to understand exactly what that would mean in practice. Jamel, I mean, you wrote a column this week saying down with judicial supremacy, that we shouldn't be deferring just to the Supreme Court to decide what the Constitution means. So what would that mean in practice? Should the Supreme Court, for example, be less inclined to throw out abortion restrictions of the sort that have been imposed in states like Louisiana and Texas if the court is not going to be the arbiter of what the Constitution requires?
I think it's worth clarifying that to say that the Supreme Court is not the sole arbiter of what the Constitution means doesn't mean that what the Supreme Court says about the Constitution is thus meaningless. I think what it means is that other constitutional actors, specifically presidents and the Congress, also make a judgment about what the Constitution means, and sort of there is actual kind of back and forth between the three branches on disputes about what the Constitution means. And I think in practice what it means is that there will be disputes that the court either doesn't step into or defers to the states, or issues sort of narrow rulings, right? I don't know. My kind of capital P perspective here is that, you know, the country seems like it's tearing itself apart, and we should be looking for ways to lower the temperature of political disputes as much as possible, and looking for ways to accommodate, you know, political minorities that fear domination by a political majority in a way that has come true to democratic institutions. And so a weak court might be one of those ways.
Michael, you wrote back in 2018 that the country needed Justice Kennedy, and that we needed Kennedy because he, sitting at the fulcrum of the court, was handing out wins and losses to each side in a way that at least restrained the impulses of each side politically and created more of a feeling of fairness, because people looked at the court and saw it as not going always one way or the other. The court moved to the right when he was replaced with Brett Kavanaugh, and the court is now likely to move quite a bit farther to the right by replacing Justice Ginsburg with a conservative appointee. appointee. So what does that mean for that feeling of legitimacy? If we're going to have a really solidly conservative court for the first time in decades, I mean, you're a conservative. I assume you're going to be more pleased about the decisions, but are you still worried about what that's going to mean for our politics?
Well, I am still worried. And the replacement of the last few nomination fights, obviously Merrick Garland, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, I think have seen, on the one hand, progressives increasingly disenchanted with the minoritarian features and protections and veto points in our constitutional order. And you're seeing that with the vogue for court packing or adding new states as soon as possible in a way that would advantage Democrats immediately. And then I think you're also seeing what Jamel just articulated, which is a rising, now that the circuit courts and the Supreme Court look to be decidedly turned to the right by the Trump presidency and McConnell leadership in the Senate, you're seeing liberals adopt a line that I think many conservatives had going back to James Burnham writing in the late 50s about the need to reassert the role of Congress in our constitutional order and the fear of a juristocracy. So I see this as potentially a healthy development. I mean, I find myself agreeing totally with Emily about an 18-year term limit. That's something that has advocates both left and right. And so maybe there is an opportunity here. I do worry that progressives controlling so many other commanding heights in our culture and politics will react to a Supreme Court that seems to be enabling maybe more conservative legislation, maybe more room for running for Republicans in the coming decades. I mean, I think the reaction could be pretty radical. So I'm worried about it. And like Jamel, I'm anxious to turn down the temperature if it's possible.
Emily, do you think that's possible? I mean, I guess the term limits, as you note, may or may not be possible to do by legislation, assuming that you could get a coalition to pass legislation to do those. But in terms of decentering the courts in American politics, is there a way to reduce their ambit and leave more to legislatures and executives? Because I think people talk about that and it sounds good in practice, but then you start laying out what I would take it to mean that the courts would do. And so you would, presumably the courts would be less inclined to do things like throw out pieces or all of the Affordable Care Act, while also being less inclined, as I noted, to throw out things like abortion restrictions. I think when people get down to those specific cases, they do see the Constitution as prohibiting other branches of government from doing certain things, and they see the court as the thing that can enforce that prohibition. I don't know that we can just give that up.
Well, here are a couple of sort of middle ground proposals, and I wonder what Michael and Jamel think about them. One would be to take away the court's jurisdiction for certain categories of cases. And jurisdiction is just a fancy word for, like, the right to hear a case. So you could say that the court doesn't get to decide whether a major piece of congressional legislation is constitutional or not. If that seems too dramatic, you could say that it takes a supermajority, 6-3 or 7-2, to strike down a piece of congressional legislation. That would give more power to elected lawmakers and to the president who signs laws, right? And less power to the court to strike them down. So those are two possible ideas that fall short of expanding the number of justices on the court. You know, what I would generally say, in line, I think, with Michael's points, is that when the court gets far out of step with the American public, things don't go well. It just doesn't work very well. We know that from the early part of the 20th century, and especially the New Deal, when a very conservative court struck down major pieces of the New Deal, FDR threatened to do court packing. It actually was a perfectly popular idea, briefly. Then it started to get less popular with people as there was more resistance to it. But what really saved the court from court packing were the justices. One and then more of the conservative justices started switching their votes, and then they retired, and FDR made a whole lot of appointments. So there is a way in which Supreme Court justices who are themselves institutionalists and care about preserving the role of the court and the legacy of the court, and I count very much Chief Justice John Roberts among these people, right? It's the Roberts Court. It has his name on it. If you care about that as a Supreme Court justice, you have a reason to temper what might otherwise be your ideological goals. And so there is a way in which that is going to potentially prevent the court from going completely out of step with the public in the way that Michael's concerned about.
Let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review, Jamel Bowie of The New York Times, and Emily Bazelon of The New York Times Magazine to talk about what a change at the court might mean for some specific policy issues. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guest is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. So, Emily, there are a number of significant cases that are expected at the court over the next few months or year or two. What are some particular areas where you think the change in the composition of the court might mean changes in what kind of decisions we're getting out of the court?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer to start with is that the court has on its docket for argument the week after the election a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. This is one in a series of challenges. So far, the court has not voted to strike down Obamacare. This, I would argue, is by far the weakest of the legal challenges. And I didn't think the other ones were particularly strong either. But it is certainly possible that this new justice could create a 5-justice majority for striking down the law. We talked a little bit about abortion and Roe versus Wade. That is very much up for grabs in the future, depending on this appointment. And then you also have big questions about gun control laws. The court around 10 years ago said that the Second Amendment includes an individual right to bear arms the first time they said that. But they've left in place a lot of laws that states and cities have passed to try to prevent everyone from carrying a gun or some people from owning particular kinds of weapons or ammunition. And those laws look very shaky now among at least 4, maybe 5 of the justices, and a 6th justice could really make the difference in that area. Let me add one more thing, which is executive power and the power of the president. And then, of course, this question of whether the Supreme Court is going to have a role in determining the outcome of the November election, depending on how close it is and whether the count in a state or two is litigated.
Michael, the Affordable Care Act cases are interesting because of the way that they conflict with some of the rhetoric that you hear from conservatives about how the court is too activist, that it is second-guessing the legislature and the executive too much. Here you have a number of efforts to get the courts to throw out a law that Republicans, when they ran the government, could not find a way to repeal and replace. And you have an administration that is not putting out its own new plan, that is nominally pursuing certain goals that were in the Affordable Care Act, including protection for people who have pre-existing conditions when they're trying to obtain health insurance. And yet the administration and many Republican-controlled states are behind this challenge. So this is one area where they've really been looking for the courts to step in, where the legislature, even when they control it, has been unwilling to do so.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me personally, this is a difficult question in that I think the court should have let Obamacare stand as it has. But I thought that Justice Roberts' ruling was so creative in doing so that it undermined a bit the legitimacy of the court. You know, there's a way it could have rejected challenges to it that would have affirmed Congress's role in this. I mean, I take the point many conservatives argue that effectively that things like the individual mandate essentially, transgress against Americans' freedom of association because the government is effectively instructing everyone to participate in a certain kind of market transaction or financial dealing with an entity that they shouldn't be compelled to do. I think that's both so broad as to be meaningless and unchallengeable as an assertion. I don't think it should have carried that much weight. But nonetheless, they're bringing that challenge. I think the court should turn it away again for its own legitimacy. But, you know, I have to wait to see, because the court is in this central position, I have to wait for the pronouncement of our philosopher king, John Roberts.
Jamel, the interesting thing about the Affordable Care Act case is that it's not a constitutional case. The original case, NFIB versus Sebelius, the case about the individual mandate, that was a constitutional case. But that is essentially moot at this point because there is no more individual mandate. It's been repealed. It turns out to have been less central to the architecture of Obamacare than I think a lot of people thought at the time the law was being written. It wasn't actually that important a part of the whole setup to make health insurance markets work. And so then you had a couple of following challenges that were basically about statutory issues. One about a drafting error about subsidies. And then in this case, there's the claim is that the individual mandate is still unconstitutional, that it had been upheld as a tax power usage by John Roberts. But since the mandate has been set to zero, it's not a tax anymore. Therefore, it's unconstitutional. And that if you strike that down, then you have to strike down all these other seemingly unrelated parts of the law, even things like menu calorie labeling. But that's something that Congress could fix. If Democrats win this election and they have a court that they find to be unfavorable, they can fix the drafting error about the subsidies, they can repeal the mandate language. So this seems like one area where you could have Congress cure this issue. And I mean, maybe there would be some novel constitutional challenge to Obamacare that we haven't seen yet. But this feels like a place that Democrats, if they obtain control of other branches of the government, that they don't need to worry too much about the court.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the interesting thing about the court's rulings on the Affordable Care Act is they seem to allow the space. They seem to close the space for overly complicated mechanisms like the individual mandate, like the – it wasn't too overly complicated, but it was a little convoluted, the mechanism for – the original mechanism for expanding Medicaid. But it leaves the door open to the kinds of things that the left of the Democratic Party would like to see, Medicare for all, universal child care, right, things that are pretty simple in terms of how they're designed but are far-reaching nonetheless. One thing I wanted to say about sort of how the court might affect policy is that one of the things that liberals are specifically worried about, but I kind of think that everyone should be worried about, is the extent to which the court, the Roberts Court, has been pretty hostile to voting rights legislation and pretty hostile to efforts to sort of reduce the politicization of things like district drawing, supportive of, you know, states that seek kind of these mass voter purges of registrations, that kind of thing. And one of the things that I think that is motivating liberal rethinking of their approach or their view of the court is this idea that they do not want to get trapped in basically a death spiral of sorts, in which Republicans win elections, you know, often, you know, in federal elections at least, helped by, you know, the structures like the Electoral College and the unusually efficient distribution of their support. And then they use that power to nominate and approve judges who then restrict legislation or, you know, strike down legislation protecting voting rights, or it just look the other way as states, you know, engage in hyperpartisan gerrymandering, engage in their own restrictions, which in turn make it more difficult for liberals to win elections and so on and so forth. And I think that is a very real fear and not a unfounded one. You look at a state like Wisconsin, where in the last election, Democrats won something like 54-55% of the statewide vote, but for the state legislature, and Republicans won something like 60% of the seats. And that kind of scenario, in which it takes basically once in a century landslides to break, you know, GOP hold on a legislature because of gerrymandering, is something that has been attempted in North Carolina, has been attempted in Texas, and is a genuine, I think, kind of existential fear for liberals and is motivating their views of the court right now.
Emily, to what extent could that be cured through legislation to the extent that it's a problem? I mean, the Voting Rights Act, there has been this effort to reconstitute certain parts of it that has been bottled up in the Republican-controlled Senate. If you had a Democratic-controlled Congress and president, how much of that agenda could they get around the court with new laws? And then also, I mean, the Congress has some ability to tell states what to do about congressional districting. I mean, for example, they're no longer allowed to have at-large districts for the House of Representatives. So could Democrats push some rules down onto states in that area through the legislature even if the court is not amenable to throwing out gerrymandered districts?
Yes, they absolutely could. And in fact, the Democrats in the House, one of the first pieces of legislation when they took control of the House in 2018 was a big new Voting Rights Act that addresses some of the issues that you are talking about and that Jamel is concerned about in terms of making sure that everybody has greater access to the ballot, kind of pro-enfranchisement bill. And then yes, Congress could take some kinds of partisan gerrymandering, as it's called, off the table for the states. In the Constitution, Congress and state legislatures are both cited as places that get to decide the rules for elections. And I think kind of in line with the broader discussion we're having, if you imagine a court that stays out of some of these fights or that liberals can't appeal to address these issues of equal rights, well, that puts more of the onus on Congress to take up that mantle if Democrats win elections. The problem that Jamel is pointing to is that if you have a kind of entrenched minority rule in the legislatures, and along with the composition of the Senate and the Electoral College, which also tend to favor Republicans, well, maybe you never really break that stranglehold. And so you have increasing minority rule actually in all three branches of government. I think for liberals, that's the kind of nightmare scenario. Or one of several nightmare scenarios at the moment.
Michael, in this vein about who's going to get to control the legislature and the executive and make laws over the next few years, one of the justifications that the president and some Republicans have been citing for why Justice Ginsburg's seat needs to be filled so quickly is that we need a full complement of 9 judges on the Supreme Court in case there are election challenges that the Supreme Court needs to consider. Now, of course, that would mean that 3 of those 9 judges would have been appointed by one of the candidates in the election, Donald Trump. I'm trying to figure out what this means as a practical matter, what they are imagining that would end up before the Supreme Court, and whether, in your view, the court could end up playing a productive role there if it did, for whatever reason, end up being central to this election.
I mean, it's hard to be predictive because we don't know what the challenges are going to be. I mean, in 2000, in Florida, the Bush v. Gore ended up being about scope of recounts, whether certain counties should be recounted or a whole state recounted. It got involved. There were legal challenges back and forth about broken ballots and how to reconstruct them and try to reconstruct voter intent afterward. We could see some of that or all of that, especially I'm worried about states like Pennsylvania in particular. I think in a country where the partisan divide is as hot as it is now, I really pray that the Supreme Court does not play a role in the election at all.
Jamel, this is the nightmare scenario being put forward by Dave Wasserman from the Cook Political Report, that basically you have a situation where the election hinges on Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the tipping point state in the last election, the state that Hillary Clinton lost by the most, that she needed to win in order to win the election. And so you could have an election that comes down to Pennsylvania. There's been this court ruling by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court saying that so-called naked ballots, which is to say the ballots that have been sent in the main envelope but not inserted in the privacy envelope that comes with that. You're supposed to put your ballot inside an envelope in the way that Pennsylvania votes. That those ballots will have to be thrown out. There's some concern from election administrators in Philadelphia that more than 100,000 ballots statewide could be thrown out for that reason, and because Democrats are more inclined to vote by mail than Republicans, it would be likely that the ballots being discarded would be heavily Democratic. So you could have a situation where Donald Trump leads Pennsylvania by even tens of thousands of votes, and you have a plausible claim from Democrats that if those ballots were counted, that he would in fact have won the state, and that would be the judicial fight that would implode the country. Now, I think I don't think this is a likely outcome for a number of reasons, one of which is that there's a lot of attention on this naked ballot issue in Pennsylvania that I think will hopefully push down the number of voters who package their ballot incorrectly. It's getting a lot of media attention in the state. And I think in general, some people have started to talk about this court challenge as though it is a likelihood rather than an unlikely but important and grim possibility. And so I guess what are you doing to prepare for that mentally, and what should Democrats be doing?
Sleeping pills? Valium?
Yeah. So I'm reminding myself that I think that's still a low likelihood scenario, that the overall presidential race has been remarkably stable. Even the race in Pennsylvania has been fairly stable, with Biden maintaining a modest but durable lead. And the one thing, and Michael sort of alluded to this, the fact that whenever one of these things pops up, right, when it was the controversy over USPS, this question about mail-in balloting, whenever these things pop up, they get huge media attention. And I think we may underrate the extent to which that's actually shaping voter behavior and shaping how people actually act. And so I think this might be the kind of thing that solves itself by virtue of the fact that everyone is so vigilant about what's happening that they're adjusting their behavior to make sure there won't be any questions, right? So I frequently hear people at least say that they're going to do early in-person voting, or they're going to drop off their ballot, they're going to vote in person. I think the interest in having the election resolved as quickly as possible is affecting voter behavior and is the thing that will prevent any of these kind of situations.
Emily, the context in which we're discussing this is one where the president faced a question about whether he would guarantee a peaceful transition of power, and he sort of demurred on that. And I think partly because the question sort of presupposed him losing the election, which is not something that he likes to think about. But it goes back to what Michael said, that the nature of a dispute over the election will depend extensively on facts on the ground. I mean, when we look at Florida in 2000 with a margin of about 500 votes in a state where there were 6 million or so ballots cast, that election was so close to a tie that people on either side were able to convince themselves and make fairly credible arguments that they, in fact, had been ahead in the state of Florida. And so I think when we try to game out in advance how an election dispute would go, I think it depends immensely on what's being disputed and whether there's any reasonable case available. I guess the question is, has the court's area to operate expanded significantly since Florida 2000, because if the odds of a repeat of that, where the state that is the most pivotal state in the outcome of the election has a vote margin that is like 1/10,000th of the number of votes that have been cast, that's an exceedingly unlikely outcome. But if you could have chicanery around an outcome where some candidate is truly ahead by some much larger margin than that, then obviously this becomes a more likely and more troubling thing for our democracy.
Right. I mean, look, if the courts get involved, that will be, it could still be a fair outcome, but it will not be good if that is where we're going, because this has become such a fraught issue. And because, frankly, President Trump is turning up the temperature so much in a way that is dangerous by putting foundational assumptions about our democracy in question. It is better for the country when more people vote. That should not be a partisan issue. Yes, we want to make sure that the elections are fair, that people aren't committing fraud, but in fact, we know over and over again from the evidence that that is rare. The president is saying otherwise, it seems, in order to sow a lot of distrust, and perhaps for sowing the conditions to challenge the election merely based on the fact that the counting process could take longer in a state like Pennsylvania. So all of that is something that, like I said, it just shouldn't be partisan. We should be making sure that we're conducting a fair and safe election and that as many people can vote in it as possible. And this whole idea of attacking a particular method of voting, it's very specific to President Trump, right? And there are Republican election officials in a lot of states who are defending their administration of elections, including sending mail ballots to their voters. We know from states that have adopted what's called universal mail-in balloting, where everyone gets a ballot in the mail. And I'm talking about Colorado and Utah and Washington and Oregon. We know from those states it doesn't have a partisan effect. So this is a choice the president is making to polarize the very administration of the election. And it's something that there should be a bipartisan sense of resistance to.
Let's leave that there on the court. I want to note this is going to be a top story in our news for the next several weeks, and we'll be staying on it. And we'll be talking about what the specific nominee means for various issues that are going to be before the court. We'll talk about abortion. We'll talk about non-discrimination law. We will talk about environmental protection and a variety of other things. So please stay tuned. But for now, I've been talking with Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review, and Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. We will all be back to talk about Breonna Taylor. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guest is Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Louisville police officers killed Breonna Taylor in a March raid on the apartment where she lived. This week, we learned that none of the police officers involved will be charged with killing her. One of the officers, Brett Hankison, was charged with wanton endangerment because of errant shots he fired into a neighboring apartment. Officers had raided Taylor's apartment as part of an investigation into her ex-boyfriend for drug trafficking because he had received packages at her apartment. This was the sort of raid police departments have increasingly used in recent years, at an early morning hour with an overwhelming show of force intended to protect the police in case they encountered a dangerous criminal. But nobody has established that Taylor or her new boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, had any involvement in the drug trade. And so when someone rammed down the door of their apartment in the middle of the night, Walker made the reasonable assumption that they were victims of a crime, not subjects of a police raid. He shot the officer who had rammed down the door to his home in the leg. Three Louisville police officers then shot into the apartment, killing Taylor. Louisville has agreed to a substantial financial settlement with Taylor's family, and that settlement also includes requirements for certain reforms to police procedures. But for months, activists in Louisville and around the country have been demanding a criminal indictment in this case, and this outcome is quite disappointing to them. Emily, my first question is, if people are outraged about the lack of an indictment here on the specific act of killing Breonna Taylor, where should that outrage be directed? Is the fault with Kentucky's attorney general, with prosecutors, and with the grand jury? Are there other charges that they should have brought here? Or are they right that there was nothing else that you could really charge the officers with and win in court? So is the problem then the law and police procedures?
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's hard to win these cases in court. I do think that with the facts of this case, the Kentucky Attorney General could have brought these charges and tried them before a jury. You don't have to know that you're going to win if you're a prosecutor, and often prosecutors bring cases where they have a reasonable belief they could win. I think that certainly could have happened here. That said, the real problem is that we have a low bar for when police are allowed to use force in a lot of states and cities in this country. The preferred standard, I would argue, is that the use of force should be a last resort. What we have instead, often, is that the police can use force if they have a reasonable belief in the moment that there's a threat to their safety or someone else's safety. And often, other officials are very loath to second-guess the judgments they make in that second. And because they know that the bar is pretty low, they shoot people in situations like this where that's not necessarily the only option they have.
Jamel, what do you make of that and of some of the reforms that we've seen here, including a ban on no-knock raids in Louisville? Do you have hope that there are improvements that will come out of this case that will make future similar incidents less likely?
I don't know if I have hope that these kinds of bans will make a measurable difference, because it seems to me that there appears to be a basic issue of accountability with the police departments, not just in Louisville, but around the country, that a refusal or resistance to the kinds of limits that reformers want to put on police departments, want to put on their use of force. You know, the raid that led to Breonna Taylor's death, none of the officers were wearing body cameras. They turned them off. And so we, you know, the officers claim they announced themselves when they knocked on the door, but we have no evidence that they did. We just have, some competing witness statements. And I mentioned that because it was 5 years ago when the conversation about reform was body cams, was if we have these independent data collection devices, we can better evaluate what happens in these situations. But it's clear that even with requirements for body cams, police officers and police departments are looking for ways to get around them. So, you know, I hope that out of all of this, there are things that happen on the margins that make the specific incident in Louisville less common. I hope that this brings some kind of modest reform, because I think that any reform is better than no reform. But for the macro problem, which isn't just police shootings and killings, but sort of the whole suite of interactions between police and Americans and Black Americans in particular, I think that to change that is going to require a much more fundamental change to just what a police department is to begin with.
Michael, does that characterization from Jamel, does that all sound fair to you? Because the talking point that we're hearing a lot from police officers and police unions and from politicians aligned with police is that basically there's insufficient respect for police in America. There's too much tolerance for lawlessness in cities around America, and there's too much hostility to the police forces as a solution to that. And I look at cases like this, and that they're, you know, apparently, for whether it was because of the laws or because of the individuals in charge of the prosecution, there was no way to have criminal accountability here. I think we see police around the country disregarding various rules that are supposed to apply to them, even in small ways. All around New York City, you see police officers with their masks off, including on the subway system, in violation of the rules that they're supposed to be enforcing on other people. Don't people have a good reason to be mistrustful of the way the police are using their extensive powers and to be wanting to find ways to rein that in and finding what we've done so far insufficient?
I think there are police reforms we should be seeking out. I am skeptical of kind of the direction Jamel was taking the conversation. I think a lot of reforms should actually involve more funding of the police, that is giving police departments the ability to hire high character individuals, be able to give them more training in conflict de-escalation, and better resources. In the particular case, I'm more on the side that the laws led people astray here. I don't think Walker would have been... I don't think he could have been convicted for shooting the policeman that he shot. And that speaks to this fundamental contradiction between no-knock raids and castle doctrines, where essentially you're saying both police and the occupants of a residence both have a legitimate right to start shooting each other almost immediately before any attempt is made at arrest or de-escalation.
Emily, I'm wondering what your reaction is to that, and to also Jamel's fairly pessimistic view on the effects of reforms that we have seen over the last 6 years or so since the incident in Ferguson that drew so much national attention to these movements. Do you see positive effects? Do you see positive frameworks to sort of reform the system that we are in?
I mean, it's really hard when you have a system where unarmed people keep getting shot, many of them Black, not to be pessimistic, because the incremental reforms don't seem to be having the kind of overarching, bigger effect that we want. You know, when I think about the conversation about what should happen next with the police, one thing that always jumps out at me is that most of the work the police do is not work that we really need someone with a gun to do. They're responding to traffic incidents. They're responding to calls from people's houses that involve possible domestic conflicts. Okay, so maybe you'd want a police officer there for backup, but you want someone who's trained in conflict de-escalation. Michael's saying, let's give that kind of training to the police. Let's give the police forces more money for that. And that's one possibility. Another is that police forces in a lot of these cities are so distrusted that you need to bring in people who are wearing different clothing, answerable to a different agency, and who really are trained in social work and conflict de-escalation, that's their job. And so I think that when you talk about a really dramatic reform, it's to redo how we do 911 services. And there are a couple of cities, Eugene, Oregon, Houston is experimenting with this. They're trying to do some of that. As far as I know, we don't have good research yet on how well that works. But I feel like that is the kind of move that could really create more fundamental reform.
Jamel, how do you respond to that? And I mean, I think there's maybe a synthesis between what Michael had to say and what Emily had to say there, which is that you have a lot of communities where there's sort of simultaneous over-policing and under-policing, where police are, you know, not protecting the community from crime and at the same time are harassing members of the community. And so I guess the question is, if you're trying to rectify that, does it involve making the police department smaller or does it just involve making it different?
Yeah, I think earlier on, Michael was anticipating that I was going to go for a straightforward defund the police claim. But I'm actually quite serious when I say that there needs to be fundamental change. Instead of relying on police departments for, you know, mental health checkups, reinvest money into building a service from the ground up for that, and then takes the police department and refocuses it around solving homicides, dealing with violent crime, handling the things that police officers should be handling. That's a fundamental transformation of what a police department looks like. It doesn't necessarily mean it's been completely defunded. I think in that case, it's going to require more money, exactly for training, exactly for building out a department that is capable of doing the kind of deep investigative work necessary for solving as many homicides as you can. So it's a fundamental rethinking of what a police department does, and one that takes seriously this idea that we do need people to deal with violent crime. We need people to enforce laws, but we don't need people with guns to handle mental health crises. We don't need people with guns to handle, you know, speeding tickets. We don't need people with guns to be posted up in schools.
Let's leave that there. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Michael Brendan Doherty, what's your rant?
2 years ago, the Catholic Church announced that there would be an investigation and report on the disgraced former Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Theodore McCarrick. We've been waiting 2 years since this time he was discovered to be a sex pest. This was actually well known in Catholic circles for almost two decades before it became a public scandal. We're still waiting for the report. And in fact, the report from the Vatican has been so long delayed that now the Vatican is being consumed by yet another giant scandal, this one financial, and ending in the disgrace of another cardinal. This report needs to come out, and if anything, the past 2 weeks and 2 years, two decades, should have taught the Catholic Church to let its sins be confessed in public.
Jamel Bowie, it's your soapbox.
The Department of Homeland Security proposed a new rule that would restrict nationals from a wide variety of countries in South Asia, the Pacific Islands, and Africa from receiving four-year visas for school, for university. They could come here for two-year college, but not four-year college. And so if the rule were to go into effect, that would essentially ban, you know, a whole host of students from coming to American universities. And I just find this very offensive. Bringing international students to the United States, allowing them to go to our schools, get an education, is perhaps the greatest form of American soft power that we have. It's the kind of thing that builds these very powerful connections between us and the rest of the world, and helps advance our national interests. Whatever the Trump administration hopes to get by appealing to its sort of anti-immigration supporters, it loses in that, you know, immigrants from many of these countries, Nigeria, I'm thinking in particular, the Philippines, are often quite conservative, traditional, religious, you know, essentially a potential popular base for the kinds of politics Republicans want to embrace. And so I just think it's counterproductive across every dimension, and it makes me pretty mad.
For my rant, Joe Biden has been calling lids very early in the day in a lot of recent campaign days. A lid is when you tell the reporters covering you that there's going to be no more news today. Often they've been doing this, you know, before 10 a.m. Joe Biden is preparing for debates, which he should be doing. And, you know, a lot of the same people who worry that Joe Biden is not spending enough time out there campaigning are also worried about how he's going to do in these debates. So it's good that he should be prepared for them. But more broadly, this strategy has been working for Biden. When you are running against somebody very unpopular who generates a lot of news that reflects negatively upon him, why should you be trying to generate a lot of news of your own when it is clear from the polling that the preference for the public is for you over whatever this other thing is that the current incumbent president is doing? I also think it's been wise that the Biden campaign has been de-emphasizing how much really energy he's putting into the debates, even though he's spending all this time on debate prep. Biden himself made a comment about how, you know, he's always started doing a little bit of that. He is working with the press and with the Trump campaign that have all been conspiring to lower expectations for Biden in these debates. So I have high hopes for Biden in these debates. I don't think he's going to be put in an Obama or Romney level performance from what we saw in 2012, but I think he's going to put in a better performance than the president and a better performance than a lot of people have come to expect in a way that is healthy for the Biden campaign. So I think the lids are part of an overall good strategy that increase the odds that he will actually be elected president. And it's something that you would see from lots of candidates who are in that position of having a significant poll lead. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Jamel Bowie, Michael Brennan Doherty, and Emily Bazelon. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.